a well-trained negotiator is not just ready for surprises, but waiting and prepared for those surprises, because they know that those surprises contain the essence of the encounter and the real juicy stuff.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Cheerological. Try this in your clinical work. Shift your stance from, I hope this works, to, I wonder how this works. Shift from the stance of doubt and an ego-propping hope that it's okay, to a sense of inquiry and curiosity. From a comment about you and your skill, to an engagement with what is, and a chance to see if your ideas actually match reality. How often have you planted your last needle, dimmed the lights, and walked out of the room and thought, oh man, I hope this works? You know that feeling I'm talking about, that sense of doubt that both tugs on compassion for your patients and at the same time feeds a sense of wanting to feel like a capable and helpful practitioner. I hope this works. That uncomfortable thought that goes through my mind far more often than I imagined it would, after being at this endeavor as long as I have. At the beginning of my practice, I thought by now I wouldn't have these doubts. Perhaps the doubts are part of the landscape of practicing medicine. In fact, I think they are. Like all of nature, humans are complex interactive systems. Whatever treatment we give is always based on limited knowledge. There is what can be seen, and there are helpful and mostly reliable signs and symptoms that can guide us, but still, there's the question, will this work? Which, really, when you think about it, it's a great question. And if we can stay the uncertainty and discomfort of investigating into how will this work, then we can get somewhere. If we can shift from, I hope this works, to I wonder how this will work, then we can shift away from requiring our patients to get good results so as to prop up our sense of self-worth and to engaging the unfolding process of understanding who our patient actually is. There's a lot of pressure to get it right, and I am not suggesting that we work in a sloppy way, but there's a lot of getting it wrong on the way to getting it right. We should do the best work we are capable of doing. But doing it to prop up our sense of self-worth is neither helpful for us, nor is it useful to our patients. Finding a way to engage that part of you that is curious and exploratory, like perhaps what it was like when you first set off on the path of thinking that learning acupuncture might be a good idea. Can you remember that? Can you recall what caught your attention that led to thinking, maybe there's something here worth following? Sticking with the process of discovery that comes from the mindset of, I wonder how this will work, it leaves us open to appreciating the deteriorations in our patient's condition as well as the improvements. Much as a true scientist is as happy to disprove as prove a hypothesis, the joy of the work is in the discovery and, more importantly, updating our understanding. I saw a sign at my niece's math classroom when there for a parent-teacher visit. It said, when you're getting it right, you're practicing. When you're getting it wrong, you're learning. Much of the time, we are practicing medicine. But the amount of time we're learning, it's not small. I wonder how this will work. It's not just a helpful question. It's a stance that keeps us open to new information. And there's always new information if we keep ourselves open to it. Margo Rossi and Nick Pohl are with us again today. You can hear Margo previously on episode 37, and Nick was on episode 49, and both were here a year ago in episode number 144, where we discussed the Tao of communication. Today, we are again looking into the intricacies of language with this conversation on negotiation as we explore the methods and perspectives as detailed in the book, Never Split the Difference, by FBI hostage negotiator Chris Voss. How does negotiation fit into the therapeutic process? Well, you're about to find out. But first, I want to take a few minutes to tell you more about the changes that you can expect here at Geological in the next few weeks. You know, at some point, all businesses have to pause and ask the vital questions of, what is my core business? What is the thing we do best? And what is the part of the business that creates the most spark, joy, and benefit? The answer clearly for me is in the conversations here on Geological. Last year, during COVID, I thought it would be a good idea to expand the scope of the podcast, add in CEU classes and on-demand learning opportunities. It seemed like a good idea as these sorts of offerings are quite popular. But what I found out was that adding the creation and administrative overhead of these CEU courses, it was taking away from the main focus at Geological, which is the conversations that you tune in for. So going forward, Geological will be easing out of the CEU business. We will continue to offer some special Geological Live events that will give you the opportunity to go deeper into specific topics through the power of conversation. These will be 1 to 1.5 hour long live video sessions that allow you to both learn and participate in the discussion. We will not be offering CEUs for these, but I can assure you the richness and the depth of the content and exploration, it will be worth the tuition and your time. For the current CEU offerings that we do have, going forward, we will be partnering with Net of Knowledge to provide that content. Our mission here at Geological is to curate East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation. You know, the power of a mission statement, like that of a guiding star, is what helps you to know when you've strayed from your true north and to get back on track. Next week, I'll be sharing some changes with you coming to the membership offerings here at Geological. All right, enough with the housekeeping. Let's get into this conversation with Nick and Margo on negotiation, empathy, and some surprisingly gentle, connective, and effective methods that the FBI uses that can also be helpful to you in your clinical work. I know it sounds strange, but it's true. Let's find out more now with Nick and Margo. Nick Pohl and Margo Rossi, welcome back to Geological.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, Mike.
Always so much fun to talk to you two. You know, over the years, I've talked with each of you individually. I've spoken with you together. It seems like at least once a year, we kind of have to circle around and have a little chit-chat. One of the things that it seems we have talked about, or at least I've mentioned in our conversations, because we're often talking about communication and how people get along or don't get along or how we can help our patients. So often there's like an element of negotiation in things, right? I mean, negotiation in the best possible way, like, you know, like what's for dinner type negotiation. Of course, there's also the more difficult negotiations. And as we were talking before getting on and rolling tape today, both of you said to me, you know, you mentioned a book to me. We had our conversation called Never Split the Difference. And both of you have gone and read that and evidently had conversations among yourselves. And so here we're going to talk about negotiation today, which is kind of interesting because usually I think most of us think about negotiation as like, oh my God, that thing I got to do, like taking out the garbage, not really pleasant, but needs to be done. And yet when we're working with our patients, we're negotiating on their behalf all the time with them. I mean, how often are we sitting with people and they're like totally negotiating against themselves in terms of their health and well-being. So welcome to this conversation about negotiation. And why don't we start with you, Margo, on what got you guys, other than my nudge, go read this book, what got you going with this?
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, so what got us going was we were paying attention and noticed that you mentioned this book three times, once with Nick, once with me, and once with the three of us together, at least. And so I don't remember, Nick, if we decided to take it on together and see why it was that Michael was mentioning this book whenever we were talking about communicating with Qi or conversing, building rapport, reflective listening in the clinic. So, Michael, we paid attention. We honor and revere you enough.
We listened reflectively.
So, I mean, I'm keen on that book. I'm curious to know, especially with the kind of work, Nick, that you do with clean language and Margo with communicating with Qi and thinking about how our Chinese medicine fits into all this. What is it about this book that you have found helpful in your work?
Yeah, so for me, I think when Nick and I started reading, we read it together. So we've been checking in every week and just sort of sharing our impressions of it. And one thing that Nick and I both have noticed is that what the author Chris Voss is talking about in negotiation, it really is about listening, the language that we use, creating rapport with the people that we're interfacing with, and also trusting that they know for themselves what they want. He's dealing with hostage takers. We're dealing with patients and clients, but it's really the same thing. The patient, the client, the person that he's dealing with has a goal in mind and isn't sure how to get it. There's a demand being made, and then a negotiation has to take place. And this is true for our patients. I think what's so evident to me in my initial intake with patients, which I still take a long time, I take an hour and a half with people just to get a feel for them when I first meet them. And it's so clear to me that with everything that they're dealing with, whatever health issue they're dealing with, they're having to negotiate and accommodate it in their life with their family and their friends and their coworkers and themselves. And they have to look at their lifestyle. I mean, if they want to. There's a lot of negotiation happening for the patient within themselves with the issue that they're dealing with. And Nick observed something else too.
I would say the more you do this kind of work, whatever kind of therapeutic work, acupuncture, for me, it's a mixture of hands-on work and clean language. And the more comfortable you get with yourself as you do it, the more you realize that ultimately you're working with trauma. It's just these layers of trauma, many layers of trauma, not just individual incidents, not just attachment traumas, but generational traumas and these many layers that it's just those layers of trauma that lie between our everyday manufactured self and our authentic self that we want to present to the world. And what got me interested when you kept mentioning this book, Michael, was that, you know, Chris Voss is an FBI negotiator. He's working with people in absolutely rough and ready, raw emotional situations where trauma is right there. Everyone's kind of quivering with it. People are with their hostage in a bank or in an apartment in Harlem, whatever. They if they come out that door, they might be shot down by the New York Police Department. They have no idea what's going to happen to them if they do what this negotiator says and come out of the door with their hands up. So that, you know, that trigger edge of trauma, just learning to be with it, learning to be comfortable with it, learning to come back to one's own safe sense of embodied presence and to almost, sounds a little strange, but to welcome it, which I guess I do now. It's like until the trauma comes into the room, you know nothing's really started. And this is another point that Chris Voss makes. He says it so well. This is a quote from him. It's vitally important to get to know, get to the clients know, or get to the hostage takers know, because it's the know that starts the negotiation. And he emphasizes how important it is in any negotiation to bring the objections, to bring the negatives into the open as early as you can. Whereas we, I think, in the helping professions, tend to want to kind of keep the nose out and just get on with this nice, happy healing process. So that's certainly where I'm coming from in relating to this stuff.
Yes, there's a very famous book on negotiation called Getting to Yes. And often, especially sleazy salespeople, when they're trying to sell you something, they will try to get you to say yes, yes, yes. They get you to say yes to something that doesn't really matter. And they get you to say yes to something else. And, not that big a deal. The idea is that if you say yes long enough, you'll say yes to whatever it is they're trying to sell you. And most of us know that. And most of us resist the hell out of that because it's super manipulative. And one of my big takeaways from Chris's work was you want to get to the no as quickly as possible. because no lets people feel like they're in charge. They've got the power. When you can say no and you can set a boundary, okay, now I'm safe. Someone's not trying to talk me into something. Of course, he's got some very clever ways of using no to move things forward. And Nick, you just said something that just went through me like a lightning bolt. Because I have heard both in his audiobook and in reading the book, Chris talk about the negotiation begins when you get a no. I think I just heard you say that when the trauma shows up in the room, that's when the treatment can begin, that there is something that's there. And until it's present in some way, we don't really have leverage in being able to help our patients.
Yes. And again, he has this wonderful metaphor of, actually, he talks about Oprah Winfrey, someone who can get a person who she's never met before in front of millions of people to share deep, dark secrets they have held hostage in their own minds for a lifetime. There's a metaphor for you. I tend to think of it as the other way around. It's this part of the person that's causing the symptoms, say overwhelming anxiety attacks or something like that. This part that's causing those overwhelming anxiety attacks is holding the person hostage. And how do we negotiate with that part? And that's where I see myself as a kind of mediator. Sometimes, as you say, you sense this trauma coming into the room, into the field, before the person does. And acknowledging that, I do it literally in words. I say, I'm talking now to that part of you that's causing these symptoms. And I just like it to know that whatever it does, it's perfectly okay for it to be here. And often what you find is it doesn't want to communicate. It's just so fed up with what's been happening for so long. It feels it's been ignored for so long or mistreated for so long that it sees no reason why it should communicate. It's just going to carry on with its behavior because that seems to be the safest thing to do. Usually, of course, these parts are parts that have, through the process of trauma, decided that they have to keep this person hyper-aroused, alert, in case anything like that should happen again. How do you begin that process of negotiation, whether it's through the needles or whether it's through some kind of presence and making sure that you are not wobbling too much in your own embodied presence as you stay with it? These are the kind of things that me and Margot are very interested in.
The listening, really important in this process as negotiators. Nick is pointing out that we as practitioners with our patients are negotiators too. And we're helping our patients be their own negotiator with themselves, with these parts that Nick brought up about the parts of us that are traumatized, that are trying to get our attention. And sometimes it feels like they're taking us hostage. They're taking our lives hostage. So there are specific skills that we can cultivate within ourselves with our work, where we are bridging this ability to be present and embodied within ourselves and to invite language into the picture, so that through language we can get to know a little bit more about these parts in a way that feels safe and in a timing that also feels safe, so that the wisdom that's already inside of us can emerge. Just very naturally, it unfolds. And there's nothing we need to actually do or fix or change. It's just a kind of an opening of awareness.
So it sounds like there are some key components. Mm-hmm. One is our embodied presence and rapport.
Yeah.
There's another element of timing. I often hear friends that work with kind of an osteopathic bend in the medicine, they use the word tempo, which I find a lovely thing to think about in terms of how I interact with my patients. There's timing, but like tempo is something else. You get a sense of the dance mm-hmm. that's involved. And the other thing that I just heard both of you say is that there are these parts and they're holding another part hostage and they seem quite hostile. and they seem problematic, often they think they are being protective and helpful and deeply, deeply unappreciated.
Yeah. Nick and I noticed this in a conversation a few weeks ago where we're both reading this book called The Master and His Emissary about the divided brain and how it has influenced culture and our evolution as human beings. But that's another conversation for another time. But it brings up that idea of the pericardium as the eunuch to the heart, and how the pericardium can usurp that mastery that the emperor of the heart holds, because the eunuch thinks it has a better idea of how things should proceed, or it's trying to protect the heart, which of course is the pericardium's job. So yeah, it can feel like we're taking ourselves hostage. And sometimes it's our body's way of trying to help ourselves. It just feels distorted.
Well, I know that, Nick, in the past, we've talked a bit about the polyvagal theory and how there is this one aspect of us that can go into shutdown. And I'm wondering here about those parts that we're talking about. Let's call them the hostage taker right now. If that's reflected in, say, the activation of the dorsal aspect of the vagus nerve.
Well, I guess you're certainly in fight or flight mode when you're a hostage taker and you don't know how many police are outside waiting to shoot you. And there are some fantastic stories in his book about the dynamics between hostages and hostage takers, you know, who are in this trauma field where somebody may die very soon. And just trying to imagine yourself into that space is, I think it's great training for staying calm and collected when you're with a client, with a patient, and they are reaching these parts of themselves which literally can overwhelm them in a second. And this is one of the things that I find, you know, people that I've been working with, that the sense that it's just going to overwhelm me and there's nothing I can do. It's just comes immediately. And how can we begin to negotiate with that? How can we begin, on the one hand, of course, to use the basic skills that we know around things like the polyvagal theory to give people some step-by-step ways to manage things, which will only ever be a way of coping. And on the other hand, how do we actually get to the deeper stuff? What is it that this hostage taker inside has in mind? What do they need? And that, again, coming back to Chris Voss, you know, what he says, I think, early on is that what they were looking for, not that getting to yes strategy that you mentioned earlier, which was devised by academics with the absurd notion that we're all rational beings here communicating together wisely. With, you know, what did it say? The goal is a wise outcome reached efficiently and amicably, is the basic model in getting to yes. And Chris Voss has this wonderful story about how he was invited to Harvard to test his approach to negotiation, which was developed in the field, as he said, not in the realms of academe, and how he actually outwitted them when they tried to negotiate him down. So he says what they were looking for in the FBI, having used this Harvard strategy and finding it wasn't actually working with people who had guns in their hands and guns at their necks, funnily enough. We were looking for some simple psychological tactics and strategies, he says, that worked in the field. He's talking about the field in the FBI sense. We're talking about the field in the psychotherapeutic sense, I think, this field of jangled emotions that's happening between us and the patient. Worked in the field to calm people down, establish rapport, gain trust, elicit their needs, and persuade the other guy of our empathy. And he says, and we were looking for something that would work and be simple to learn, because after all, these guys are cops and FBI agents. They're not academics and they're not psychotherapists. And similarly, and you know, my work is training mind-body workers to to appreciate how the chi flows through the language that people use and how they give themselves away so readily and beautifully with the words they say. But we're not training ourselves to be psychotherapists, and we're not trying to be academics. We're looking for something that works in the field to calm people down, establish rapport, gain trust, elicit needs, and persuade this other person of our empathy.
You just said that patients give themselves away with their language. They beautifully give themselves away with their language. I heard that, it just lands with this sense of, I think that's right. I think about certain encounters that I've had in clinic, and I wouldn't say that I approach it in the same methodical, conscious way that you might because of the training that you've got and the ways that you think. But I do know those moments when people say something and I can hear the truth of it, or I can hear something in there that's not being said and yet it has been communicated.
Not being said and yet it has been communicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of two beautiful lines from Philip Larkin's poem, The Trees. It starts out, it's about trees in spring, late spring. The trees are coming into leaf, like something almost being said. That something almost being said is what we're attuning ourselves to, I think. And it comes through the qi, as we call it in Shiatsu, or the qi, and through the spatial expressions, through gestures, well before it comes into the words, but the words themselves will also be carrying it. Yeah,
it makes me think of, and Michael, you know this because you've studied clean language too, that one of the beauties of language and the art of negotiation is, at least in the clinic, if we're talking about clean language, is supporting the patient or the client to come up with a metaphor for their experience. And that metaphor is speaking the truth in a way that's subtle. So I have an example. Can I give you an example? Something?
Yeah, I would love to hear an example.
Because this case so beautifully, I think, outlines this art of negotiation and how we can support our patients in negotiating with themselves, and to do it in a way where we're not inserting our own agenda. We're not inserting our own wisdom or knowledge or medical theory. We're just inviting them to discover for themselves what's already inside, what they already know. It hasn't yet emerged, but the metaphor can help them see it, as you're saying. So this is a case of someone who works in human resources in a situation that's residential. So she's working with people who live together during COVID. And it's a fairly isolated situation. So she's in HR. She's got this pressure of navigating the pandemic. At the same time, several states away, one of her parents is dying. And so she is looking at that huge change in her life, and she's come for assistance in having crippling anxiety. She's having a lot of anxiety. And through this process of clean language, I'm inviting her to come up with a metaphor for that anxiety. Now, I could put that aside and just go, okay, we're going to work with the eight extraordinary channels or the low vessels or the primary channels, and we're going to give you these herbs, and maybe you could use these essential oils, and you could try this lifestyle practice to deal with the anxiety. But instead, she had requested this kind of session where she was exploring. And her metaphor for the anxiety was, it's like a column of transparent gray mist with a high-pitched sound that's driving me crazy. And the mist is slightly acidic and corroding. And she says it's constrictive and it's hampering my life.
And I just like to pop in there and say, people are always amazed. As the therapist, you're amazed, but people are amazed themselves with the clarity and detail, almost like some animated movie suddenly appearing in their head, what these metaphors actually convey. That's amazing.
And then she goes on and says, it needs to go away, you know, so that her life isn't hampered anymore. And she hears herself say, it needs to go away. And the next thing she does is say, does it need to go away?
Oh, wow.
And realizes it wants to stay as long as possible because a massive change is coming in her life, a massive reorganization, like a void or an abyss, and she doesn't know how to deal with it. So she realizes the anxiety is helping her kind of stay away from the edge of that abyss, and discovers again through more clean questions that really what she needs is trust and faith to stand on the edge of that abyss. And that's what she's looking for. How can she build her trust and faith? And then I asked her, what will happen when you have the faith and trust? And she says, the quality of the void changes to something that is less existentially defined and more like a thing to be explored. You can build those skills that'll help her. So thank you. I just wanted to share that because it seemed to fit in with several things that we've covered already.
I see this in my work as well, and I've seen it in my own life as well, that there are these parts. I call them troublesome, or my patient calls it a problem. And yet, as we were speaking earlier, there is something about this troublesome thing. It's actually trying to be helpful and protective in the best, or maybe the only way it knows how. And I would dare say I would label these parts as fiercely loyal, not unlike any kind of shadow material that we may carry from a Jungian perspective, that there is something that is actually enriching, but we haven't connected with it in a way that it can be assimilated and digested. But it is loyal. And my sense is because these parts are loyal, giving them that opportunity to say no, how often have those parts had an opportunity to actually say no?
Yeah. And of course, this takes us back. The art of saying no is something we start to develop fairly slowly as infants. But the art of becoming enraged, we'd start to develop pretty quickly if there's no food or comfort available. A lot of these parts that hold us hostage are very pre-verbal parts. That's why the sort of Harvard model is going to fall down completely, because it's based on the idea that we're all rational beings wanting a wise outcome. Actually, we're not rational beings yet. We're enraged beings wanting some kind of compassionate outcome. And how to stay present with that, how to bring all those appropriate qualities to it. And I think Margot is wonderful at doing this, because those things you mentioned before, all the other options, the oils, the acupuncture, sometimes that can be such a relief. That those things are available, and that there's someone here who cares about me and is offering these possible ways to calm things down, to establish rapport, to allow me to express my needs in some way, or to allow these enraged or terrified parts to express themselves in some way. So that's the work, really. And another thing that I always start off with is to emphasize this thing about negotiation. I don't use the word negotiation, but I do say collaboration. And one thing Chris Voss says is negotiation is the heart of collaboration. So in the old model that I was trained in, yes, that people come for shiatsu and I'd ask them a few health history questions and lie down, and it would be my job to sort them out with appropriate advice at the end and so on. Nowadays, I do my best to make it clear right at the beginning, this is a collaborative process between you and me. I want you to feel completely as if this is your space. And, you know, my job here is to facilitate some kind of improvement in communication between your everyday thinking mind and whatever's going on in your body mind that you're not happy about. And I'll be asking you a few simple questions to help facilitate that. But if the questions don't work, that's fine. Just don't answer them. And then we, you know, might go into some kind of simple embodied kind of contemplative dialogue process, or I'll ask them to bring attention to the body in some mindfulness sort of way. And usually that's where the conversation starts, the conversation between the person and their body mind. And it, as Margot just illustrated, it very rapidly becomes very often quite fascinating as you begin to explore this inner landscape and these metaphors that emerge. But it is collaborative, and sooner or later you get to the point where some negotiation is required. How would it be if you could just keep breathing and stay present with that feeling of anxiety as it arises in your chest? That's a negotiation, you know, that I'm making with the person and that they're making with their own breathing. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure. Well, of course it makes sense to me, Michael. Does it make sense to you?
It does. And again, I am often struck at the power of metaphor to bring forth tremendous amounts of information and at the same time to give some distance from that thing that's being hammered on, the thing that's been hammered on for who knows how long, and nothing's changing. Bringing a larger view to that, whether it includes kinesthetic experience or like Margot, you were describing, there's sound or there's a visual component to it. Now you've got more handles.
Yes.
To work with.
Yes.
And it's a bit safer because we're not talking about, I'm using air quotes here, the problem. We're talking about this other thing.
Yes.
And so I wouldn't say necessarily that we have leverage now, but again, maybe we have some handles to work with. Does that make sense?
I saw Archimedes clapping. He thought, handles, leverage. And it's not our having leverage over someone else. It's our having leverage over what we're experiencing in ourselves that we have. We can grasp it. We can get a handle on it. This is one of the beauties of language, is it helps us grasp our situation so that we can work with it.
Okay, I want to dig into this just a little bit because I feel like you just held up a carnival house of mirrors to me. All right. So often I think in working with patients, I'm there to help them shift something. But you were just talking about noticing something in ourselves, mm-hmm. using that. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
I just want to be clear of that we're understanding the same thing. I was speaking of patients have a gratification through our relationship. It is essential for the practitioner also to have a grasp of themselves. And actually, Chris mentions it in his book that if the practitioner isn't able to regulate themselves, negotiation will not work. That is the key. So really, I think everything Nick and I are speaking of, it has to start with us, ourselves first. For one thing, we're modeling it for our patients. For another thing, if we use the metaphor of being a negotiator in a hostage situation, we have to have our own grounding and our own ability to touch into the resources we have inside ourselves so that we can use them as a handle for ourselves And then again, share that. And that's what makes him such a brilliant negotiator, is he is able to do it. He doesn't tell us how to in his book, but Nick and I do. we have some ways of doing that that have worked for us. And we know that for our students and our patients, it works for them too.
He doesn't talk about the skills of embodied presence very much. He does talk about making sure you're using the right tone of voice, which have to be connected with your body to be able to do that. But also, I just wanted to say, Margot, that he does say, make sure you have a good backup team. Make sure there are three or four people at least listening, not just you, as the hostage speaks to you on the phone, because those three or four people are going to be hearing different things. And I think that's true, because I'm with my ears, I'm hearing some things. With my heart, I'm hearing other things. With my gut brain, I'm hearing other things. I really need to be tuned into my body and think of myself as a team. When I'm doing my trainings with students about this, I get them to work at least in threes, so that there's a client role, a practitioner role, and then there's a third person who's just listening and noticing how it's resonating for them in that embodied way, which is a kind of a luxury you don't actually get in clinical practice. But boy, do they learn a lot from just being in that listening role. Yeah, I just wanted to add that in there, Margot.
Michael, was that on track with your question? Did I get that right or wrong?
No, we're getting there. We're getting okay. There.
Can I ask you a question, Michael?
Yes, of course.
Because you've mentioned this book and so many times with such enthusiasm, it got us reading it. And I'm just curious how it works for you in your clinical practice. How do you find yourself applying Chris Voss's principles?
Okay. So how does it work for me? One of the things that I love about Chris Voss, and especially listening to him in interviews and such, is, you know, he's this kind of New York guy, you know? He's like a wise guy. And he talks about being in these situations where he's dealing with kidnappers who are happy to kill people. That's not a problem for them. And so he talks about that you've got to self-regulate yourself, much like you guys speak about with an embodied presence. You got to self-regulate yourself. And he talks about you got to come across is that late night FM DJ, right? You put yourself in that place. You use your voice like that late night FM DJ. And if you can regulate your voice can down regulate any kind of triggered emotions that you might have. Simply by using your voice, simply by putting, so for me, if something's happening in the clinic and it feels like, ooh, this is ramping up, and I feel myself ramping up, I know some people take a deep breath or they like put their feet on the ground. I will do what I can to take my voice from being kind of where my Adam's apple is and drop it down to where my sternum is. And it helps me in clinic. It settles me down. My voice changes a bit. I find people tend to respond to that voice that's a little bit deeper, a little bit quieter. There are some pauses in it. And I find that very, very helpful.
Yeah. And of course, that's taken us right back to the polyvagal theory and to Chinese medicine. The heart is connected to the tongue in Chinese medicine. In polyvagal theory, it's this tone, voice tone, which is the first way a mother communicates with her baby, a non-verbal baby. It's the, you know, it's the right side of the brain that develops first in the womb, because it's that right-sided, in the moment, non-verbal kind of communication that a baby needs when it comes out to get any handle at all, speaking of handles, on what's going on in this weird and wacky world where you're not just floating around blissfully in amniotic fluid, hopefully blissfully. Maybe your mother's having traumas while you're in the womb. So, yeah, that voice tone and, of course, touch is another great way to get through when these tidal waves of emotion or trauma threaten to overcome.
Yeah, and there are other skills of rapport building that can also be useful to help influence that vagus nerve system. Sometimes the prosodic voice that you're speaking of, Michael, doesn't work if somebody's really in a traumatic space. So there are many other rapport building skills that we can use if we're aware of them to help in that situation.
Can you give an example of a few?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, rapport is about being, we like people who seem to be like us. You know, when we can find similarities and we can build a bridge, that's when we feel safer with somebody and we feel in rapport. So just as you did when you were talking about Chris Voss, listening to him on, you know, his TED Talk or on his podcast, this New York-y kind of guy, you know, he's rough and scrappy in some way. That's one way. You can kind of mirror somebody's voice and tempo of how they're speaking, the kind of words they use. So they might not be speaking in the FM DJ nighttime voice. They might be speaking in a really hyper aroused way, and you can match their tempo. That's just another way to build rapport, to build a bridge. And I just want to give a shout out to anybody who's thinking, wow, this can be so manipulative. Yes, it absolutely can be. So, you know, our intention in coming to this isn't about having an agenda that you want your patient to follow. It's really, and Nick, you can chime in, and Michael, you too, since you work with this, what your agenda is. Mine is definitely that my perspective is that there are these disenfranchised parts of ourselves, marginalized parts of ourselves that are really calling out for recognition and to be honored and noticed and not to be fixed or changed or put aside or shut up. And through this process of rapport, we're making friends. We're making friends. And that's not a manipulation. It's a reaching out of the hand so we can connect.
And it's clinically approved, I would like to say. In the sense that making friends, you know, there's the befriending is, it's a part of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is research evidence-based process. This process of befriending not just the patient but these awesomely dictatorial parts that they may be bringing in with them, and step by step finding ways that one can befriend these things in oneself. Absolutely. And Chris Voss talks about how that instead of going the academic route, they went to the psychotherapy route to find the resources, to find the skills that they wanted to use in the field, as he says, and did find that those were effective. And reading his book and looking at all the amazing quotes that he comes up with, which are exactly like the way I have found, you know, effective work happens, I'm really struck by how much they resonate with the kind of Zen principles or Taoist principles. Like, you know, he says, you've got to step out of your ego. You've got to negotiate in your counterpart's world. He also refers almost directly, without using the formal title of, you know, not knowing, that Taoist principle of not knowing. But he says, instead of doing any thinking at all, calm your head, to quiet your head, make your soul and all-encompassing focus the other person and what they have to say. And this is exactly the kind of skill you need to develop if you're using an approach like clean language. You just turn the inside of your mind into a recording device, and you listen to the words and the tempo and the tone and timbre of those words, and just allow them to resonate inside your head and filter down through your body, and then you offer them back, almost like a tea ceremony. Ah, you just offered me this, and I'm offering it back to you. And then the same thing happens to the other person. They hear the words they just said, but they actually sound different. There's more in there than I thought I was saying. And the process begins. It's reciprocal, and it's always collaborative, and every moment contains a little micro-negotiation.
There is something powerful about taking the words that somebody is saying, but they're maybe not quite hearing themselves completely, and offering it back in a way that they can hear what they're already saying to themselves. That really is like magic. I mean, it's if there's a Jedi trick out there, I think that would be one of them. But it does take what you guys were just talking about, that not us having an agenda for ourselves, but being able to be sort of that clear reflective mirror, but not the complete mirror. It's like this mirror that can reflect back the particular parts that might have a bit of a charge, or the particular parts that aren't being listened to, or those particular parts that, again, maybe the person themselves is trying to hear, but they've not been able to hear.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for saying that. I love in this book how Chris says, it may look as if there are just two people in the room having a conversation. For him, it's the hostage taker and himself, negotiator. It may look like there's just the patient and the practitioner in the room. But when you look at it, how many voices are in each of our heads? We have the voices of our teachers and our past patients, our experience. We have the voice of Lao Tzu and Chuangzi. We have the voice of our spouse who we just had a fight with, you know. And then the patient has all these voices in their head too. So when we offer this reflective listening where we speak back exactly the words that they've given, like Nick said in the tea ceremony. And as you're saying, Michael, they have an opportunity to hear it. And just like the patient in the case that I shared, the response was, it needs to go away. And then she gets to reflect on that. Wait a minute, does it need to go away? And realized somewhere inside of her came, no, it doesn't need to go away. Here's what I really need. So that listening piece is so important, and feeding back so we can hear ourselves. We don't really see ourselves very well. That's something in NLP you can't, or actually, my teacher Jeffrey says that you can't change the mind with the mind. There's a you need something meta to the mind to help it see itself. And this reflection is like that. It's very powerful.
So I want to come back to something that Nick had said earlier, that in a hostage negotiation, because there's so much information going back and forth, and because even if you're a skilled hostage negotiator, you're going to miss a lot because you're like embedded in that system. You're enmeshed in what's going on. And so they will often have other negotiators listening for other information that the main negotiator may have missed. And Nick, you brought up that for us in our clinical settings, you know, we have our rationality, we have our feelings, we have our heart, you know, we have like how we're hearing things, that there's other parts of us that in a sense are also listening. And it seems to me that we can bring not just our intellect to this, but we can bring our heart to it. We can bring our emotions. Sometimes we just bring our emptiness. And it has something that it has heard that the rest of us hasn't heard.
Absolutely. Is that a question?
Well, it's a comment. I want to see, does this make sense to you? Or am I just off on a tangent?
It's always moving to remember, to realize that. How much of you there is outside your head, as you're talking about hands and gut and so on. Sorry, heart, you said, and gut. I was really remembering.
Heart, yes. Although you could put your hands on someone, and that can also give you information. That's also in our ballywhack.
Absolutely. I was remembering that. It's my hands know stuff that my head will never know. I think Carl Jung has a quote to that effect. You can often solve problems with the hands that the intellect has no idea how to resolve. And it reminds me, that, again, reading all of the things he suggests, that of the skills of not just of Zen, but of improv, which is a hugely popular thing these days, even in business work. the emptiness. Improv, you come onto the stage with nothing. That's the whole point. If you come on with a script, you're already trying to shine as an actor, like the way we maybe try to shine as a practitioner. You come on with nothing except your body, your embodied self, and this deeply trained willingness to be totally present with the other person on the stage, other people on the stage, and to see what emerges from that. And one thing Chris Voss says is a well-trained negotiator is not just ready for surprises, but waiting and prepared for those surprises, because they know that those surprises contain the essence of the encounter and the real juicy stuff. And so being ready to be surprised, being empty, listening with your whole body, being prepared to stay in that stage of not knowing. And for me, when I think of improv and Zen, the non-doing aspect of Zen, how do you pronounce it in Chinese? Wu Wei, is the playfulness of improv. It's like, we're not doing, we're playing. And even in these another moving part of the book is where he's talking about these very fraught situations, but moments of almost playfulness, moments of genuine rapport, moments where a hostage taker is revealing things about themselves. And just as Oprah Winfrey does, getting people to talk about their deeper needs and injuries and emotional wounds that have got them into this situation in the first place, all of that stuff. So, I just think improv is another great thing to keep in mind as a model for how to stay present in testing times.
Yes, listening, it's like whole body and maybe auric listening. I don't even know what it is, what other body is listening, but there is this sense when working with clean language with patients, or I'm sure in any, whatever context you're working with it in, language rapport, that you're not just listening with your ears, you're listening with everything. We all know that feeling. We know that feeling when we're with someone and something has deeply resonated with them and it has shifted their consciousness, it's shifted their frame. You can see it. And you can see it. Their face changes. Their voice changes. They might slow down and say the next few words really slowly, like, aha, like they're savoring it, like, whoa, this is something special. So you might see it with your eyes. You'll hear a change in the tone of voice. But you also feel something in your body, like, you know, oh, something shifted. And learn from Nick, that's the physiology is shifting and we're looking for those changes. And then we know something has emerged for that person that's really critical and important. And to me, cultivating that skill of listening, not just with my ears, but my eyes, my sense of smell, maybe even the taste in my mouth, the feeling in my body, what's happening in the space between us, all of that we can cultivate. Anyone can cultivate that. And so, you know, I find mindfulness practice and my Taoyuan movement and yoga and working with clean language as I do those practices has really helped me emerge into my senses. Nick, do you have anything you want to say about that? Or Michael?
I just love that phrase, emerge into my senses.
Now you're doing just what Chris Voss does. You're repeating the last few words that Margot just said and savoring them. That's the point. Not just manipulatively repeating them back, but just savoring them for what they mean to you. I think that's the first step in creating rapport through a process like clean language. You're appreciating what the person just said, rolling it around in your mouth, getting a sense of it, and then offering it back. Yeah.
It really is. It's such a gift to receive. It is like a tea ceremony. It's an honor and a privilege to witness and not even witness it. I love one of my teachers, Alice Wheeldon, who you had on your show. She speaks of it, it's not so much witnessing, it's actually like if you've ever ridden on a surfboard, which I love, feels so good. You feel like you're not just watching the wave. You're actually experiencing the feeling of the wave as it moves through you, in you. And that's what it's like being with people. It is such an honor to work in this way with people.
I want to come back to something you said a little bit earlier, because I think it bears repeating, that all the skills we've been talking about, the perspectives that come from this book, and even the perspectives in our work trying to help people, they can be seen and they could be used as manipulation. These are very, very powerful aspects of how human beings communicate and are with each other. And so if your intent is to sell something to somebody or sign them up for a package of 25 treatments or sell them a bunch of herbs or sell them a car, I mean, whatever it is, these skills can take you a long way in manipulating other people. All right. Now, many of us have built in kinds of senses of, oh, this is off. But again, these skills are very powerful and they generally run underneath conscious awareness. We were just talking about how most of us are not rational creatures in the first place. So I just want to say that that's there. And these are also incredibly powerful tools when used with heart and caring and looking to help somebody out of a jam. When I think about Chris Voss talking about the experiences that he's had working with terrorists and kidnappers and bank robbers and stuff, I don't get the feeling that he's trying to get that bad guy out of malice. He's trying to help the people that are trapped in a bad situation. And that bad situation includes the bad guy.
And remember, he started his training doing the helpline for people, suicidal people, that when he went to the woman in charge of FBI negotiation, the negotiation team, asking if he could be on it, she said, only if you go and work voluntarily on this helpline for people in deep trouble. And he did. And he learned so much about himself there and how he wanted to bring his own agendas in and shine and, you know, be seen to be a great helper on a helpline. And that's, I think, with the point about clean language, that's why it's called clean language. It's because the questions are so simple. They're absolutely designed to keep our own agendas out of the client's space, of the patient's space. And so it isn't that manipulative. But if there's one more point I'd like to make there, slightly reframing, the word manipulation comes from the word for hands, Latin for hands. And I do manipulate in some ways as I work with my hands in a benign way, I hope. But I think that comes back to that good old Zen principle, the difference between the beginner's mind and the expert mind. It's not that the beginner's mind is the be all and end all. We do need the expert mind as well. The expert needs to be able to do some benign manipulation, sometimes quite seriously, like working with somebody who's having a panic attack right there in the session because they bumped into a metaphor that seems so terrifying that they don't want to go there. And, you know, sometimes I just have to be the expert and say, take a deep breath. I want you to stand up. I want you to move around. You know, that's expert mind stuff and it's manipulative, but it's in a good sense. So always getting that balance. And as Margot was saying, that Ian McGrill, Kristen, his brilliant work on the difference between the right and left hemispheres, it's about getting the balance between the left hemisphere that wants to get results, that wants to shine as a, you know, so it's expertise and knows stuff, and the right hemisphere that's right there in the moment, totally attuned to what's actually happening, which is the essence of Zen, as far as I'm concerned.
I think we're back to this embodied presence that Margot often talks so much about.
Yeah, the body tends to tell the truth.
Body tends to tell the truth.
May I make another comment about assumptions and biases? Because that's another thing that Chris Voss brings up. I think that's a really important point. Having been a science researcher before I became an acupuncturist, One thing that I got very interested in when I was in graduate school was how to design a study that was free of bias and influence. So, you know, I got into quantum physics, and here I am being an ecologist doing field work, observing. I was observing birds. That might not sound very scientific to some people, but I was hired by the National Science Foundation to do it. How can I do that really fresh without influencing the system that I'm looking at? And when I was at Rutgers, I was reading through articles. What did former researchers find about being in the field? And was there any information? Were there any studies on how a field researcher influences the system they're looking at? And by golly, I found two separate articles that blew my mind. And basically, these were researchers, you know, respected researchers in the field saying, just your presence creates a ripple in what's happening. You cannot see a system without your biases. It's not possible. And these two studies were showing how the birds responded differently to having a person in their environment. We think we're in a blind and they can't see us, but they're not stupid. We're there. And so many of my research, we always had a camera watching them, and then we had the researcher come in, and then we observed how they responded to those two different things. So as Chinese medicine practitioners, we bring a lot of bias into our practice, a lot of assumptions. We have our own body of gorgeous metaphors. But even just sharing the metaphors of Chinese medicine is influencing our patients, because they might have different metaphors. We might talk about wind and fire and heat and cold. And though those really resonate for people, because we all know what that feels like, they might have a different metaphor. And this is what I love about this practice of clean language, is we get to hear what their metaphors are, and they get to hear them too. And then they can change from that.
Yes, and they get to hear them too. They get to hear them too. The thing about being in a field and observing a field without influencing the field, I mean, yes, that very quickly gets into quantum physics and that whole sense that it is impossible to observe anything mm-hmm. without changing what's being observed is exactly. Such a Hall of Mirrors idea. And at the same time, we can take that, like you were just talking about, we can be aware of our awareness. And we can use language in a way so that we can watch our own mind.
And Carlo Rovelli, I think his name is, the guy who's the best explainer of quantum physics at the moment in terms of putting it into popular language, has recently come out with a new book in which he specifically goes back to Buddhist principles and says, this idea that has got so embedded in our minds that the observer changes things is maybe better thought of as simply an acknowledgement of interbeing, of everything related to everything else. And that has to be a bottom line principle in the kind of work we're talking about here, I think. Everything's related to everything else.
And that's gorgeous. And what a powerful, the presence is powerful. It's powerful medicine.
So we began today with negotiation, thinking about negotiation, talking about it. Often when people think negotiation, they're thinking two sides, and there's kind of a battle going on. Someone's going to win, someone's going to lose. And after this delightful, winding conversation, I think we're coming around to that there is this field of interconnection, and it's how we pay attention to that interconnection, the parts of us that we bring forth, or maybe even hold to the side so that our patients can bring these other parts of themselves forth, because it seems to me that's where the gold really is in the healing encounter. Does that make sense?
Well, Chris Voss, to come just to one more quote, it talks about, he said there's a kind of involuntary neurological telepathy each and every one of us in every given moment is signaling to the world around us whether we're ready to play or fight or laugh or cry. This involuntary neurological, he calls it telepathy, but actually we're, you know, there are plenty of ways you can track how we're communicating these things to each other. It's not just through the chi or the energy, as some people like to say. But that's one way of thinking about it. And another thing he says is that in any negotiation, human connection is the first goal. So it's like, yes, getting the right kind of human connection is the goal. There is always human connection there, whether it's whatever we're involuntarily signaling and connecting. Getting the right kind of connection is the goal, and that human connection in which we're present, not just in our heads or with our language, but with our bodies and how they're communicating with each other. That's really important stuff.
I did find Chris Voss's book to be a beautiful melding of intensely manipulative and also honoring work. So I'm just thinking, if anybody picks this up, I wouldn't want them to think this is my Bible of how I want to work with people, because there he is working from a metaphor of something to be fought or subdued or shifted. He's invested in that and here. So, you know, just to your point, Michael, of speaking of, you know, you brought up manipulation. I just want to say that out loud for folks, that this, it's a brilliant, has brilliant insight into the art of negotiation, which we do in clinic. The way he goes about it, his intention is different from ours. So, maybe that's explicit already, and maybe not.
Well, it's worth keeping in mind. I would also like to suggest that, like any powerful tool, your intention behind the wielding of that tool is what makes it a surgical scalpel or a murder weapon. And there's also a delightful story in the book. I think it's one of his students who managed to get an upgrade on an airline at a time when there was all these snowstorms and big events. I mean, there were like no seats to be had. People were waiting for like 2 days to get on a damn airplane. And one of his students managed to get himself a first class upgrade on the next flight out. And using very simple skills of reflection and some of the empathy, getting people to say no, all these things. And the thing that I found so fascinating about it, not only did that person get that airline out in a good seat, but the person who was working the counter had a better day because of interacting with that person. That person was seen. That person was appreciated. That overworked, being yelled at by hundreds of people, airline employee came away with a moment of, my day is okay and there are decent people in this world. So when we start looking into communication and getting what we want and helping other people get what they want, I don't think it's so cut and dry as to, is this manipulative or is this just for me? Because sometimes it really is for us. And I think especially in our clinical encounters, it is for us. It's important to remember.
I think that's really important to remember, because the tools we have are so powerful and can be so manipulative in themselves, and we can get very attached to that. He does, on page 54, quote Sun Tzu, as everyone does. The aim is to subdue the enemy without fighting. And beyond that, I guess the aim is to get out of that frame of mind of thinking this is an enemy. This is something I can befriend. And when we do, I think the only thing that he doesn't say in his book is how to negotiate with someone who's already read his book. If there are two people using Chris Voss techniques with each other, then what happens? And I just kind of have this image in my mind of at some point they suddenly realize, hey, you're doing the same thing as I'm doing. And there's a twinkle in both eyes, and they come back to remembering, this is all about human connection. Let's get this negotiation rolling. And we can do it in a friendly way. Yeah, but never split the difference.
Well, my friends, it's always a delight to hang out with the two of you.
Very much so. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. We feel the same way.
Absolutely.
All right. Till next time, then. I read Never Split the Difference a few years ago, and it's a great book for learning to, as author Chris Voss says, letting others have your way. I so appreciated this conversation with Nick and Margo, exploring how these negotiation techniques can also help us to help our patients. It occurred to me back when I was reading the book and starting to attend to some of the nuances and use of language and empathy that my patients were often negotiating against themselves, that they would play their weak cards thinking that they were a better person for doing so, or they would ignore inner resources and strengths as they had a low opinion of that part of themselves. With our medicine, we help the body and mind to function in a more integrated state of harmony and coherence. Needles, of course, can help with this, and the skillful use of language and attention can also assist our patients in being more connected to their essence and Zheng Qi. And, of course, in the process of running your business, being able to negotiate in a respectful and effective way, well, that's always helpful. Nick's book, Words That Touch, and Margot's new upcoming book on language and movement are both ways to further explore the use of language in the therapeutic setting. Details and links to those are over on the show notes page. It's almost summer here in the Northern Hemisphere, and the Cheological Audio Journal will release its first quarterly edition around the solstice. I hope you'll enjoy the variety of views, perspectives, and methods that you're going to find there. And if you'd like to contribute to the audio journal, send me a postcard with the topic that you'd like to share. All right, that's it for today, friends. Tune in again next week for a conversation with a longtime seasoned practitioner who's taken her already successful practice and made it even better.